Hey, if you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. First of all, it's free. There are creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer, which I personally find very convenient. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you, so it can be heard on Spotify or Apple Podcast and many more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Hello again, and welcome back to History Revisited with Reflection. I'm Kevin Stewart, and in this second part of a two-part episode on the complex problems that were faced under the Articles of Confederation, we're going to be once again exploring the question that we kind of started the first episode with, and that question was, what kind of an outcome tends to happen when we react to a situation out of fear rather than responding with more sensible actions? As I said in the first episode, stick around, because we're about to explore that very question. I'm Kevin Stewart. I teach history, and this is History Revisited with Reflection. We're going to start out this episode with a mental caveat real quick to help us understand the minds of the members of the Massachusetts elected legislature at this time. And I'm calling this mental caveat, why didn't they see this coming? Because that was the glaring thought going through my head at the time, like, oh my gosh, how did they not see this? So to give me some understanding and to share that with you, I searched around and found the work of psychology professor Daniel Todd Gilbert. And he points out something in his book, Stumbling on Happiness, that really helped me to understand a lot of this. And so I'll share it with you. First thing he points out is that humans are wired to see the immediate threat to their lives, such as terrorism, which we've had a few examples of in these last few years. And that we hyperfixate on this perceived immediate threat, even though the odds of it happening are statistically very low. The third thing he points out is that while we as humans don't tend to concern ourselves all terribly much with a gradual threat that is very probable, such as the eventual need for retirement from work, you know, but we do tend to concern ourselves a lot with this perceived threat or this, you know, concern that's on our mind. The fourth thing that Professor Daniel Todd Gilbert points out is that, that humans tend to trivialize the important and make the trivial things seem important. Or to put it in another way, humans tend to major in the minors and minor in the majors. Professor Gilbert outlined four ways that the human brain is wired to see something as a threat. The first one is if there's a clear and present danger in the short term, in the immediacy. The second, if there's a moral outrage. And the third is that if there's a human threat, that is that the threat has a human face. And finally, if it's a sudden and thus shocking situation. These are the four ways that the human brain tends to identify what the threat is or to see something as a threat. During this time in our nation's history, debt on a personal level was allowable or acceptable only so long as a person could repay it. You know, the idea of defaulting on loans was massively frowned upon. At the time, they still had things called, you know, like debtors' prisons. And some American Revolutionary patriots actually spent time in debtors' prisons because of the problems that they racked up, the debt they racked up. And the state would feel an incredible sense of failure and shame if they were not able to repay the debts that they'd borrowed. And so that being on their minds, this was a massive issue. Another thing connected to moral outrage was that on the state level, if the state of Massachusetts was unable to repay its debts in a timely manner, this would be a huge sense of shame, which was to, of course, be avoided at all costs, because then anybody involved in it would also be seen as, seen in the negative light. And possibly even their status as a gentleman might, you know, could be called into question. The fourth thing I want to point out about moral outrage in this case is that no gentleman could hold his head up with honor during that time if he had participated in the legislature that was unable to pay the debts owed. And so there was a lot of personal prestige on the line, a lot of personal pride. And so there was a sense of moral outrage looming around the corner if they failed to pay this debt. Their own personal reputations were on the line. The third thing that Professor Gilbert points out is that, you know, did the threat have a human face? Well, in a way, this threat did have a human face. It might credibly be argued that the faces of the creditors were known to many in the Massachusetts legislature, and that they were known by name, the first one being the King of France, Louis. They knew what Louis looked like. All of his coins were stamped with his face. I mean, the man had a face that they knew. And in many ways, some of the Dutch leading bankers were also known to the legislators of Massachusetts. And therefore, in many ways, the threat did have a human face. Who wants to look a gift horse in the mouth, you know? Not going to happen. So, I mean, this was a massive issue for them. And whereas thousands of citizens of Massachusetts who might suffer from the austere actions of the legislature were perceived as a statistic. So, I mean, the people in their own homes, their own state, they didn't have all of their faces in their minds, but they did have the face of the King of France because of all the coins that had been stamped in his name, you know, all of the, or with his image. It's kind of similar in a way to the fact that just as thousands of Americans die in car crashes every year, and most of them don't have a face that we see, and so therefore they become merely a statistic to us, even though they are fellow Americans. While a terrorist who takes over a plane halfway across the country with a knife or a, you know, some small razor blade, that person's face is plastered all over the newspapers of the country and is thus perceived as like the threat, you know. It's kind of the weird anomaly, and that's why I found Professor Gilbert's work so helpful to me, was because he helped to explain this very weird, bizarre phenomenon that humans go through. You know, Americans are not immune to this in any way. Fourth thing that Professor Gilbert brought up was the fact that this was sudden. Though the debt repayment plan had been known to the state of Massachusetts for a while, from its beginning, its repayment date may still have felt rather sudden, since Massachusetts was only now able to start recovering from the effects of the Revolutionary War and the demands of being their own sovereign entity. So they were their own state, you know, controlling their own affairs. I kind of picture this as like an adolescent young person just out of mom and dad's house, all of a sudden getting hit with bills for the first time. And they're like, whoa, you know, they thought life would be a dream, you know, and all of a sudden, whoa, this wasn't what they were expecting. Too much of their small paycheck is going to, you know, pay the bills just to make it. And all of a sudden they find themselves thinking, should I go home and do my laundry? Because I don't know if I have any money for the laundromat. Anyway, that seems to be the thought that's going through my head as I was reading these ideas from Professor Gilbert and reflecting on what Massachusetts was going through at the time, as well as other states, not just Massachusetts, but they're kind of the archetype in this case. So here's my thought, and I want to put it out to you and see what all of you think. If you're willing to reach out to me in an email, I'd love to hear from you, and it'd be so cool. I'd actually share your thoughts if you do reach out. So given that the Massachusetts legislature appears to have given more importance to the thought of repaying the debt it owed to the King of France and several Dutch bankers than it did to how its own citizens might be affected by its decisions, how might the Massachusetts legislature have acted differently if their focus had been on the health and protection of their own citizens? Take a moment, give it your thoughts, and see what you come up with. You know, I mean, this is definitely a difficult situation to be in. There's probably no easy answer, but see if there's some other way. It's really healthy to kind of consider the other possibilities or opportunities and reflect on them, ponder them, and sometimes they'll come back to help us in our own lives. So there it is. There's my thought for you. I look forward to seeing anything you have to share. All right, we're going to transition now back into the complex problems faced under the Articles of Confederation by starting with the veterans of the American Revolution themselves and the incredible sense of betrayal that many of them felt, in part due to the rather predictable recession or depression that hit after the war. In all of world history, that is the normal set of circumstances that when war ends, there ends up being a large recession or depression. That did not occur, of course, after World War II. Instead, it ended up in economic boom times. And you can look into the reasons for that on your own, or you can wait until I get a chance to do an episode on it, and I'll of course, go over that. But for now, it is important to know that they did go into a massive recession, and I would argue it was actually a depression. And here's why. From 1775 to 1790, And so essentially, we had just finished the war. We were excited about our newfound freedom and our sense of a new nation. And we go immediately into a recession that is arguably actually a depression and almost as bad as the Great Depression. 2 percentage points off. I mean, that's not much difference when you're looking at a percentage point of 46 and 48. So with steep increases in taxes and the huge recession that followed in the post-war years, the absence of a sufficient currency was crippling. And you can see why Americans deeply struggled in these post-war years. Historian John L. Smith Jr. stated that America's Revolutionary War was very expensive. Not only did it sap economic resources in the country, but the depreciated currency also acted, as wise Ben Franklin put it, among the inhabitants of the states as a gradual tax upon them. Since Americans have been used to very light taxation before the war, it follows that after independence, with U.S. taxes rising, well, precipitously, I mean, just in a massive way, this was a huge shock to their system. From 1792 to 1811, U.S. per capita tax rates were over 10 times higher than the imperial taxes levied by the British from 1765 to 1775. And that is a massive difference. It's kind of like the old proverbial phrase, out of the frying pan, into the fire. We didn't like the fact that our feet were being burned under the frying pan that we felt that members of the British Empire was rendering us as, basically it was being cooked. But we left that and we jumped into something that was even worse in many ways for quite a few years. Now, it makes sense then that under the weight of all this pressure, financial pressure and the burdens that come with it, incredible burdens and stresses on the family, that average citizens, regular citizens, those that don't have the huge reserves would be yelling and crying, enough is enough. Any adult who's lived long enough can tell you that there are moments that life seems to hit us like that. When the government of Massachusetts chose to tax the people of the state directly and only accept specie as payment, or hard coins and gold and silver as payment, and it seems that they did it without regard for the low amounts of specie in circulation in rural areas and the impacts that might have on the people, it was for many people in that state a final offense and one that could not be overlooked. Starting in the end of August 1786, those who openly rebelled against the Massachusetts legislature were part of a rebellion that became known as Shays Rebellion. Before the Revolutionary War, those who opposed unjust taxes were known as Regulators, sometimes thought of as patriotic or patriots, especially as the war loomed ever closer. Because they were seeking to regulate or even out the unjust taxes of the British Crown, you know, taxation without representation and all that that entails. But now, after the actions of the Massachusetts legislature, citizens in that state began to band together as regulators once again. It makes sense that when you're going through really hard times, you don't have time to come up with something new, so you revert to old ideas, and one of the old ideas was, in fact, the idea of rebelling as regulators. In the process, four men soon became known as the leaders of these regulators, and they were, initially, they weren't called Shaysites. They were called regulators. That was the term that was being used about them quite a bit. But after a while, they became known as Shaysites, and here's kind of how it happens. Job Shattuck of Groton, Luke Day of West Springfield, who led the regulators from there, Eli Parsons, who led the regulators from Chicopee. I hope I pronounced that right, by the way. I'm not from Massachusetts, so I hope I got that right. And Daniel Shays, who led the regulators from Palmer in the surrounding area. And as I mentioned that, be sure to check out the cameo episodes I'm going to be producing on these individuals. It should be a fun experience to get to know more about them and just begin to see how real and normal these guys were. They weren't like horrible, you know, lawless people. They were regular citizens. So just a little tidbit there for some future episodes. While at first the regulators had some success in that they were able to get some of the courts to close, by force, by threat of at gunpoint, you know, in the case of pointing their guns at some of the judges and saying, get out, we're locking the doors, you know, run for your life now or we're going to take you prisoner. Ultimately, they faced an inability to sustain their successes. And there are some reasons for that. The regulators were short on ammunition and arms, and they didn't have huge pockets to purchase more. So this was a definite problem. They realized their need for more arms and ammunition, and they ultimately marched on the federal arsenal in Springfield and ended up confronting the Massachusetts militia. It was quite a spectacle, and I will do an episode just on Shays Rebellion coming up here shortly. I have been collecting resources and whatnot to prepare for that, so hopefully you'll get to enjoy that soon. The militia had an artillery and used it with deadly force. During this conflict at Springfield, between the regulators known by this point as Shaysites and the Massachusetts militia. In many ways, the fight at Springfield was over before it started. However, the actions of the regulators exposed the utter inability of the state and the federal governments to deal with the violent uprising and maintain order. Indeed, George Washington felt like Massachusetts was teetering on the verge of anarchy during this time. Also, it exposed the utter inability of the state or the federal government, which was really weak at the time, to uphold law and maintain harmony. And to that end, Massachusetts and other states such as Pennsylvania and New Hampshire were in varying degrees failing both the creditors and the debtors, and by extension, failing to preserve private property, failing to uphold the rights and liberties of their citizens by extension of that, or if you carry it a little bit further. The other states also suffered court closings, and New Hampshire, too, was briefly confronted with an armed rebellion. That being said, there's a couple of comments I want to make about that. One, I made a comment about the fact that this uprising was over before it started, and that largely goes back to a famous phrase, the battle is fought in the halls of Eton before it's ever fought in the field. It was a phrase that was used in the days of the British Empire, and the idea being that those who approach war in a smarter way with better weaponry and are better prepared and better trained, they stand to gain much more out of any fight than those who show up haphazardly and have not been through a lot of training. And so the armed militia that met the Shaysites at Springfield was in many ways better prepared, having trained together frequently, and better armed, better supplied, and in some ways better led. When you have several different captains, it's kind of like too many cooks in the kitchen, and nobody really knows who's the leader in charge. So in a way, the Shaysites had a huge disadvantage in that sense. There wasn't a unity of command, is what we would call it nowadays. So I mentioned drastic times call for drastic measures. And that is important to note because the need for the Constitutional Convention was growing. People were becoming aware that our country really needed something more stable to provide the stability that is needed for everyday life and for business and commerce. Because to a large extent, a very large extent, the sole remaining possibility for a solution to the problem of the war debt and all of the violent uprisings that surrounded it seemed to be the development of a new form of government capable of both organizing the total resources of the nation and gathering them in without provoking popular rebellion. And that was going to take some real careful management. Whatever that government was would have to be a national one, capable of countering the hostile economic policies of foreign powers and of maximizing domestic revenues from such taxes as the impost or the import taxes. Its precise structure, exactly how it would be formed, that is, however, would remain in doubt until after the Philadelphia Convention. So no one really had a strong sense of what it for sure would be, though many of them had ideas of what it should look like or have included in it. In the immediate wake of Shays Rebellion, one thing was very clear. A radical new departure was necessary if public credit, the absolute prerequisite for the founding of enduring republic, was ever to be established on a national scale. And more than that, if peace and tranquility would long prevail in our country. Interestingly, not all American voices were opposed to the actions of the captains of these regulators. It is worth noting that Thomas Jefferson, when he learned of Shays' Rebellion in letters from John Adams, John Jay, and his dear friend Abigail Adams, he responded with these words, "The spirit of resistance to the government is so valuable on certain occasions that I wish it to be always kept alive. It will often be exercised when wrong, but better so than not to be exercised at all. I like a little rebellion now and then. It is like a storm in the atmosphere." And that was a letter that he wrote to Abigail Adams on February 22nd, 1787. But another example is found in a letter that he wrote to William S. Smith, which was dated November 13th, 1787. Jefferson wrote regarding the regulators, "Let them take arms. The remedy is to set them right as to facts, pardon and pacify them. What signify a few lives lost in a century or two? The tree of liberty," and this, I found this part most interesting, "the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure." What an interesting way to see things. You know, while most people in the country were saying that what was occurring at the hands of the Shaysites and the Massachusetts militia, but also in New Hampshire with their issues and in Pennsylvania with the View uprisings, most people would suggest that those things were terrible. I just felt the need to include Jefferson's voice because he's kind of a lone voice in that area. There doesn't seem to be a lot of other founding members of this country who felt as uniquely as Jefferson did. But you can see in these comments why he would have a preference for revolutionary France. You can kind of see that bent towards the devil's advocate at the very least, and if not, then certainly a bent towards revolution and changing up things, making things new and different. Jefferson's an interesting character. So here's a few takeaways. In studying the calamities that led to the undoing of the Articles of Confederation, it seems that making reactionary decisions to something that we fear often does lead to dangerous outcomes. When the Articles of Confederation were created, what was feared most was the strong central government that might strip American citizens of their rights and freedoms. And this fear was not necessarily irrational. As indeed, Governor Bowdoin of Massachusetts at the time, of which Bowdoin College is named after him, he had stripped any citizens of Massachusetts of their right of habeas corpus if they were believed to have been siding with the regulators, which is egregious. I mean, it's a horrible idea that you could take away people's freedoms and liberties and their protections against unjust government simply because you believe that they're siding with the regulators. I mean, that's not even giving concrete proof. You have a hunch, you know? So you're going to strip away their protections just because of that hunch. And that's the mark of someone going down the road towards a dictator or a dictatorial stance. And that's a scary stance. And what's even more scary is that Governor Bowdoin had made sure that this was carried out without giving them a fair trial. You know, there was no freedom, no fairness. It was just your freedoms are wiped aside and I'm going to go after you. It seems that things we as humans run from out of fear are the very same things we end up arriving at if we make our decisions out of fear. And that's kind of the interesting thing about all of this. I stumbled across this notion a few years back that it's uncanny how many times in history people run from something they fear only to end up arriving at that same fear. It's almost as though fear is a hunting dog and it's got a great nose, you know, and just follows you. And no matter where you go, it just finds you. And that's a scary thought and a great basis for a horror movie, perhaps. But if, however, we push our fears aside and base our decisions on care and concern for others, on the advice and counsel of a variety of opinions and, you know, people of knowledgeable backgrounds, if we can make better decisions that support our hopes and dreams, then we often arrive at an outcome that is not what we feared. I've heard it said that love and fear are opposites, not love and hate, but love and fear. And I don't mean in this case, in terms of relationships. What I mean is in terms of the experiences we're facing. So if we're feeling the threat of fear, our best response is to act out of love. And that can often be disguised as caring concern for others. Familial or brotherly love, you know. And in acting for others, we find the courage to do what we need to do to calm down and be patient. We're more likely to find it, I should say, there than if we simply act out of fear. We also often take a moment to reflect and make wiser decisions. And I'm noticing that when they made the Articles of Confederation, it seems as though those articles were made out of a lot of fear. Whereas when they deliberated extensively at the Philadelphia Convention, which was also known as the Constitutional Convention, especially nowadays, at that convention, a lot more intentional deliberation went into it. And during that convention, they were no longer at war with England, so they weren't as pressed. They had the luxury of a little bit more time to reflect and think and ponder and come up with new and refreshing ideas. And you see a better result come out of that situation, with the incredibly egregious exception of the Three-Fifths Compromise. Again, something I noted previously, and I believe the last episode, something that may have at the time been considered political genius or compromise. Sometimes there's a haziness between those two qualities. But certainly now is considered inhumane on every single level. And as such, thoroughly un-American, just terrible, egregious. The idea that a slave would not be considered a human being at all, but rather just property, and not even count as equal to a person, but less than a person. And we'll go into more about how that happened and transpired in the episode on the Constitutional Convention, which is a forthcoming episode. But in the meantime, it's enough to ponder that largely, with that notable exception, and that is a big exception, largely the Constitution was a much better document, and one of the only living documents ever created. And again, we'll talk on that more in the forthcoming episode on the creation of the Constitution or the Constitutional Convention. In presenting all of this to you and kind of the summative hope that I have from learning about all this is that all of you will begin to be more reflective on the events you're facing in your lives, and as a result, try to be more intentional about responding out of care and concern for others or even perhaps yourself. And instead of responding or reacting, I should say, out of fear, to pause in the moment of panic and reflect and come to a better solution, because it'll help your life. You don't want to be making your decisions out of fear. Certainly, it will lead to bad results. And of course, as I mentioned, fear will follow you as a hunting dog follows its prey. I'm hoping you'll make your decisions based on counsel and advice rather than fear. Well, before I wrap it up, I wanted to take a moment to thank a new listener who's tuning in from France. I thought it was really exciting to see that someone from France is listening to this podcast. Thank you so much. And thanks again to the continued support, listening support of folks around the United States, but also Germany and the Netherlands. We've had pretty consistent listening there too. And so grateful for all of you. You make this even more interesting for me than it would have been otherwise. So thank you so much. If you've enjoyed this experience, please consider subscribing. Also, please become a sponsor of this podcast. Your direct support helps this podcast to continue providing the depth and reflection, as well as unique or outside thoughts that you've come to love and appreciate, or at least I hope you've come to love and appreciate them, given that you've made it this far, which of course come from a variety of disciplines and authors. I hope that you do, because I love what I do. Please remember to reach out to me. You can email me at historyrevisitedwithreflection@gmail.com. And you can check out the website, which is historyrevisitedwr.weebly.com, where you'll find a free poetic reflection. Or you can also, check out the list of sources that were used in this episode. And finally, please continue to build a disposition of reflection and discernment so that you're more likely to thrive. I hope that you do. So until next time, goodbye for now. Thank you.